Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome in to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio. Don't forget you can first catch us each Tuesday lunchtime, 1 p.m. right here on the station, or download a podcast. Just ask your smart device for the latest episode of RNIB Tech Talk. Don't forget, of course, it's our opportunity each week to get together and explore the world of technology from a blindness or low vision perspective. It's your show and we're always delighted to hear from you. You can contact us in the usual way. It's an email to techtalk@rnib.org.uk, techtalk at rnib.org.uk. This week we'll be hearing about SenseBall, a new multi-directional cane tip from Australia. Hubert finds out how to get started with programming, plus lots more to come this time on Tech Talk. Welcome in to our co-hosts, Hubert Pavalkovic and Jackie Brown. Good to have you both with us once again. Welcome back, Jackie. You've been away on your hollybobs.
Yes, I have. I went to visit family, and I have two little grandsons, 5 and 19 months. They didn't know I was coming, so it was amazing when I got there and I was launched upon by two very excited little boys. So it was good.
Fantastic. And Jackie, what's on your kind of tech radar this time?
Okay, well, this is an interesting one because I have bought a new laptop for my business purposes, because I have an RNIB role and a business role as well. I run my own little business. So I bought a laptop to keep all that stuff separate. And unfortunately, I had last weekend when I got home, I spent 2 whole days. You know how it is when you've got a new machine. Windows takes ages for all the updates to go through, updating drivers and so on, installing applications that I wanted, customizing JAWS, etc. And lo and behold, the machine kept rebooting, and I thought there was something really odd going on. It can't just be Windows updates all the time. And by the time I got a drive and transferred stuff on it onto my laptop, it kept rebooting when it was only 10% through. And I thought, there's something going on here. I contacted the company where I bought it, and the laptop apparently seems to have a CPU hardware problem. So it's gone back and it's gone back to the hospital, and it is either being replaced or updated in some way. But anyway, I'm minus my new shiny laptop at the moment.
Well, that's a shame. Blimey. Oh, well, look, keep us posted with that. Hopefully you'll get a new one pretty soon and they can sort that out. What did you bear in mind? I mean, when you were choosing a laptop, Jackie, did you do a bit of shopping around? How did you arrive at the choice of the particular machine that you went for?
Yeah, I wanted a custom-built laptop because very often if you go into your local store or Currys or somewhere like that, they will sell you something that's probably full of bloatware, lots of onboard apps. And I decided I didn't want that. And I also wanted quite a high spec with using Teams and JAWS and Zoom and all these online things that you do. So I went in the end to a company in England called PC Specialist. They are very good with blind and visually impaired customers. So if anybody is looking for a new laptop and they don't want to go local, if you like, they are a good choice, PC Specialist. So we've bought from them before anyway. So they were really very good. They were on it. Once they discovered there was a hardware issue, they in fairness, did book in a collection straight away. It's a laptop with a numeric keypad on it as well. So it's slightly bigger. And I chose an SSD hard drive and an SSD, which stands for solid state drive, in case somebody doesn't know what that jargon is. But I chose 2 SSD drives so that I could put quite a lot of stuff on. And I chose quite a bit of RAM on it as well, because, you know, when you're online all the time, When I'm doing training and things, it can use up the resources. So that's what I did. So hopefully it will be back on my toy table soon.
And that numeric keypad, you presumably you've got that for JAWS, have you?
Yeah, because I think it's quite useful to use some of the JAWS keystrokes using the insert key and the numeric keypad. So I went for one of those, although I do tend anyway to add an external USB keyboard or a wireless keyboard. I do tend to do that anyway, but it's handy if I go out on the road somewhere with the laptop and I don't have too much to carry, then I've got the built-in numeric keypad. It's good for training.
That's what I've recently done with my new work laptop. I've requested a numeric keypad with the laptop itself, so it's in built in because it's just nicer. You have that full keyboard function without having to carry around an external keyboard, then a laptop, then a braille display, then a headset, then 5,000 other things.
That's right.
So it does make a nice change to carry one item less, I think.
When I'm in the house, it's fine. It's not a problem. I'll just use my external keyboard because I do that on my work laptop as well. So I don't mind doing that at home, but if you're going out, it is useful just to be able to have that extra functionality, as you say, Hubert. And that's what I've done. So hopefully it will be back from the computer hospital in a week or so. And if it is a hardware issue with the CPU, as they think, that stands for central processing unit, if people want to know what that means, then hopefully they will replace it or replace the motherboard on the laptop and get it all sorted out.
Okay, well, there you are, numeric keypad. Who would have thunk it? I never missed it, to be honest. Been a laptop user for quite a while now, and I almost think that screen readers should have the laptop keyboard layout as the default, you know, because most people are using laptops. Do you use a numeric keypad like Jackie and Hubert? Let us know. Hubert, what's new with you?
It's AI. So Freedom Scientific have been talking about new kind of changes with their products, Zoom, Fusion, JAWS for 2025. And one of the new things they've launched, which I think is quite something, is the Freedom Scientific Companion,
Yes.
which is an AI website portal thing that you can use and ask it questions to do with various Freedom Scientific products. So, for example, if you want to know a specific JAWS shortcut, you can just kind of type a question and ask it. And the good thing about this is it's just a website, so you can access it, for example, on your phone if you are using JAWS on your laptop, and you can just quickly ask it questions like, you know, how do I access files in Microsoft Teams with JAWS? Or, you know, any question relating to JAWS or certain third-party applications, most notably probably Microsoft Office applications, you can actually ask it questions and it will peruse the JAWS documentation for you and find the right information so you don't have to.
And you can copy it as well. You can copy that information once you've got it. Obviously, if you want to store it as a note somewhere or whatever, I've tried it. It's brilliant.
I've been trying it just now before we recorded, and well, I find it very nice for that reason that you don't have to go through all the documentation to find what you're looking for. You can just type out a question, and that information is there.
Right. So if you wanted to, let's work through an example then, Jackie. What have you tried it for?
I tried it when I was setting up my new machine. I asked it the question about joining or linking Microsoft Teams to Outlook just to see how it would work. And it came back with a really useful summary of what to do. I knew how to do it anyway, but I was really impressed with the kind of the layout that, the language that it used and the summary of it. I thought it was really good. I think trainers beware, because once everybody finds out about what the new feature is doing, it's going to save people a lot of time by just typing in something and not relying on a trainer or somebody online that they contact to get help. So it actually is really good.
Having friends in the training business, and what me who wanted to go into it myself last year, it's an interesting one because, yeah, at the moment I don't know if it can replace a JAWS trainer in certain aspects. I certainly don't think it can, but it is certainly something that could, you never know what it could lead to in future developments.
Yeah, I think there's a difference, isn't there, between between being able to do something confidently yourself, having been trained to do it, and just getting the information because you might need to do it once. So how do we get to the Freedom Scientific Companion service?
I found it by typing in FS Companion into Google, and the beta is the immediate first thing that comes up for me. And you get put straight away into the text field once you click on that link, and you can type away.
There we are. So if you use a Freedom Scientific product and you'd like to take that for a spin, search for FS Companion. Hubert Pavalkovic, Jackie Brown, thank you so much. Stick around. It's another Tech Talk.
You are listening to RNIB Connect Radio, and it's time to talk coding. Now, if you ever wanted to know how to get started and how coding works when you're visually impaired, well, we're about to answer some of these questions, at least. Joining me is Craig Brett. Craig, thank you for joining us.
Hello there. Happy to join you.
So before we kind of get into the coding side of things, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and kind of your sight loss?
My name's Craig Brett. I've been blind since birth. I believe my diagnosis at the minute is something called Leber's congenital amaurosis. My eyesight is pretty poor at this point. I'm primarily a screen reader user. I mostly use NVDA and VoiceOver on my phone and very big print. I've always had a passion for sort of computing and things like that, mostly for gaming. Gaming led me to it, and I fell into coding from that, essentially.
So when it comes to coding, I mean, you've studied a lot of IT subjects, but how did you actually get started with coding in the first place?
So my first foray into sort of coding itself started with me playing around with and modding an old computer game, Command & Conquer Red Alert. And I discovered that I quite liked being able to change the variables being used there, unlock sort of almost new features that were sort of left for modders to find. And that sort of got me into playing with it. And then I decided to sort of take it a bit further. And when I was actually attending the Royal National College for the Blind in Hereford, I got some sort of very informal tuition from a nice gentleman named Tony Sales, who taught me to code my very first game, which was Pong, as always. It's almost the first game most people learn. And we learned that in quite an archaic old language, well, it feels archaic, called Dark Basic. So me and a few others that were interested sort of got that opportunity there. And in my case, and perhaps in a couple of others, actually, if I think about it, it ignited a want to sort of push the coding further and see what we could do with it. And now it's come through to be my career.
What were you using to code the Pong game, as you said? Not in case of language, but more kind of as to, did you use particular software to code, or was it kind of simply using something like Notepad where you can write code?
It wasn't a million miles away from Notepad, and some of my earliest coding was all in Notepad. So in this case, I think it was the text editor that came with the particular tooling we were using, but it wasn't quite as accessible as if I was using Notepad. So I think I use Notepad for some things. So I used that alongside, I think I was using a combo of JAWS and Zoom Text.
Because one of the good parts in coding is that you can literally, if you want to, hand code using a text editor. Is that correct?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. You need nothing more really to start off with than a simple Notepad or the Mac equivalent, and whatever assistive technology you'd normally use, which in theory will be very accessible with tools like that. So yeah, it can start like that. And some of my earliest programs did. I think even as far as perhaps my second year of university, I was coding Blackjack in a browser. So I wanted to make a player versus computer version of Blackjack. And I hand wrote all the files using Notepad. So a bunch of HTML and JavaScript files. And it worked. I think I got pretty good marks for it.
How has your coding since developed? I mean, you said it's your career now. So you went to university. What happened from there on?
So I did my studies at the University of Northampton. I've known for years I wanted to take the computing path. And I decided to go for that. So at college, I took A-level ICT, did pretty well. And so went to university, took computer science. I wasn't entirely sure I wanted to do software development at that point. I knew I wanted to do something. The good thing about most university courses for computer science in general is they'll give you a bit of a sort of broad taste of the subjects that you might be studying. So whether that's networking, these days it'll be machine learning, etc., or whether it's coding. And even when you do take coding as your sort of your primary focus, you will dip into the other fields. So in my case, I did, I can't remember exactly what it's called, but I think it was media programming. I got unlucky and I ended up doing it on a visual programming as opposed to, say, audio programming, which would have suited me much better. Going through that broad breadth of subject matter there at university, I really decided, yeah, this is what I want to do. I want to write programs. And came out of it with a 2-1 and went off to do some consultancy work, which was turned out to be unpaid and somewhat a bit nefarious. After that, I landed a good role at a small firm, and the rest is history. I've been a software engineer going up through the ranks for about the past 13 years now.
What sort of programming language are you mostly dealing with at the moment these days? What is it? What tends to be the one you encounter the most?
My role has slightly moved into the realm of what's called platform engineering, which is building the tools and the systems that help other people do their software engineering. So in my case, a lot of the languages I'm using now are Golang, or Go as it's often called, which can be done again just for a simple text editor, and Python as well is something I'm using a heck of a lot of. And they're both really good languages, very different from each other, but also very powerful. I came into the industry using something called C Sharp, which I also have a really good soft spot for. And yeah, I think any of those would be really good starting places for people if they're looking for languages that they might be interested in writing something in. Although I'd never neglect something like JavaScript, which you'll need if you're going to do anything on the internet.
What sort of software would they need? We've talked about Notepad, so I guess all they need is a simple editor. What languages would you recommend are the most important ones? You mentioned JavaScript. Would you say HTML is equally as important these days still to learn?
I think it's still important to learn. There's a lot of technology out there that essentially tries to abstract a lot of these things away from you. But ultimately, whenever you're re looking at something in a browser, and in a lot of cases, and in a lot of the apps you're using on your phone, it's actually boiling down to HTML. Handwriting your own HTML page is pretty easy, particularly if you walked through doing it. So I'd say HTML and JavaScript is a great place to start. It can be incredibly rewarding as well to have a notepad open in one sort of window and a browser open in the other. Save your changes in your notepad, refresh your browser, and see the difference you've made. Or if you broke it, you'll see you broke it. Switch back over, try and fix it, save it, press F5 to refresh it again. It's a very quick feedback loop. You get quick results. You get to see the results of your labors very quickly. If you did want something that's a bit more advanced than Notepad, that's fully accessible, I'd recommend something like Visual Studio Code, which is the text editor I found that is best for both coding and also being really, really good accessibility wise. A lot of their changes, like if you read the stuff that they do when they're updating it, there's normally some sort of accessibility improvement or something they're trying, which is really good. They're very responsive to that. If you're happy with running something, say, on a command line, Python is a very good, simple language to get started with. You can start writing Python in like one line of text, and you will get still, even to today, a lot of jobs come up in Python. We use it quite actively where I am, and a lot of universities will use Python as well. So it'll open a lot of doors to you whether you want to go on to further study or straight into work, depending on how good you get with it.
How can people find resources to, someone who's starting from the beginning will not know how to even code a link or a bit of text or even a heading. Where can people get these sorts of resources that basically tell them, if you write this, it means this?
Back when I started, and this would have been a bit before it fell out of fashion and then fell back into fashion, I was learning web programming using something called W3 Schools, which is a very simple text-based website which will teach you the basics of JavaScript, HTML. It also offers lessons in other languages like Python, I believe. I've not used those, so I can't vouch for them. But that's what helped me learn HTML, JavaScript way back when. And it briefly fell out of favor for having a few inaccuracies or using things that weren't best practice. I think it's then correct since corrected those. Particularly if you're learning web programming, it might be something like the Mozilla Developer Network, or MDN as it's called. And I believe they have some good, again, text-based tutorials where it will show you the code and it will talk you through in text what you're doing and what things are for. And I've occasionally referenced those even today. For other languages, a lot of it is language specific. I've used things like Pluralsight before, which is a paid for product. It's the accessibility of the app itself and the website is good. It might be for listeners who have a little sight as opposed to no sight, because I don't know how much of the code that they show when they're showing coding things is going to be in textual format. But at the same time, I've managed to use it to learn things, even with my very limited amount of vision, because sometimes they will show code on a video, but they will also then link you to an actual copy of the code so you can read what they're talking about. I'm going to give out a last sort of bit of advice there. For I know some people are skeptical about these, but feel free to ask an AI, particularly for very basic questions like what's the best way of doing a heading in HTML, or in Python, how might I write something that goes over a list? Something like that. An AI should be able to answer that in not very much time at all, and it should be a very easy question for an AI.
One resource I want to ask you about, and I don't know if that's the same thing, but I've heard something, and I've briefly given the HTML course a go on this, something called Code Academy.
Yes, that is one it's one I've heard of. It's one of those ones where I'm aware of its existence and haven't tried it for accessibility, so I'm hesitant to vouch for it in case someone tries it and it's not accessible. But if you've tried it and you're saying it's accessible, then I would say it's definitely revered, or it's certainly respected in the industry as a good way of starting learning programming. I'm not sure if they give certificates and awards, but they will carry a little bit of weight as well. So if it is accessible, I would definitely suggest giving it a go.
From my experience, it's been quite accessible, and it worked pretty well from the little bit I've done it before I changed career kind of paths. But that
That's
worked
good
pretty
news.
well. So definitely give that one a go because it does take you through really well. One question I do have, and you'll kind of probably see where I'm coming from with this one when it comes to screen readers. There are one or two particular screen reader settings that you probably want to change in order to do coding, which will be different to what it would be if you're reading just a basic Word document, aren't they?
Yes, I would say so. And two that spring to mind to me immediately that I'll always change are reading out punctuation. So normally when reading punctuation, you don't really want it to read out left bracket, so and so, right bracket, dot, blah blah blah. But in coding, those are quite important separators and delimiters that will say, ah, this is a thing that must happen to the. So say if it was prig dot say hello, that dot is actually quite important because it says Craig is the thing and say hello is the thing is the action you want the Craig to take. So punctuation is one. The other, and it very much depends on the language you're using, is if you have some way of identifying what kind of indentation is going on, that is also a useful setting to turn on. So I believe in NVDA, for example, there's a way of playing a tone to indicate how much indentation is going on. And for languages like Python, which I know I've recommended as a good starter language, indentation actually matters. So it's a good thing to have turned on. So you're aware if you need to, oh, I've not started this line far in enough. This particular quirk of a language, most like if you're using Visual Studio Code, it will most of the time take care of it for you if it thinks it knows what you're trying to do, but it's worth having turned on. Those are the two that spring to mind.
It's the punctuation one that I was hoping you mentioned because that is literally probably, you can't really go w into coding without having every single punctuation sign read out to you because of how essential they are.
Exactly. Annoying as it is, they really are crucial.
I know when I was learning HTML and I've turned on the punctuation, it was irritating at first, but without that, you simply can't get started because then you have to read character by character when I was. If you've got that turned on, it
Oh.
will do that reading for you and
Yes.
make it a lot simpler. So there we go, some coding tips for you. If you're looking to get started with that and you've got any more questions, do let us know. We'll be more than happy to bring Craig back on and answer them. But if you
Absolutely.
are keen to start with coding. Hopefully this will give you some few tips. There are obviously courses you can take academically too, but it's a little bit to get you started before you consider that option. And then once you get into special courses, then people will hopefully guide you there. But thank you very much, Craig Brett, for joining us here to talk all things getting started with coding here on RNIB Connect Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hubert speaking with Craig Brett there about getting started with programming. Are you tempted, Hubert? Are you going to give it a go?
I mean, it's an interesting one because I've dabbled in HTML and tried to learn it, and I found it quite fascinating, especially, I mean, coding on its own, I find quite boring personally. However, what I loved is when you actually code something, and I used Code Academy particularly, as mentioned in Craig's interview, and I loved being able to see the results of what I coded, being able to see that actually then reflected in the little project window. I just found it fascinating. I never got more excited than when I could wrap text around an image.
Jackie Brown, have you ever dabbled with any coding?
In a word, no.
Fair dues, fair dues. I had a go back in the day. I did an A level in computing, and we had to learn Pascal, which is a learning language. I'm not sure how much it's really used in industry. And used to waste so many afternoons looking for a stray semicolon that might be in the wrong place. And I just found it hugely frustrating. And I remember as a kid those magazines that you used to be able to get, and I used to try and rope in a family member to read the programs out the back of the computer magazine. And they were in BASIC and all the lines were numbered, and you're like 10 print, hello, my name is Jackie or whatever, and you get it to make sounds and fun stuff like that. And the people reading the programs quite often were just family members who didn't know what some of the symbols were. So they'd go, oh, it's a squiggly thing, David, and I'd have to try and work out what was the squiggly thing on my keyboard. So it definitely helped with my learning to touch type, but I didn't really stick with the programming. Did a bit of JavaScript as well. Got my head around some of that for a while, PHP, but that's all in the dim and distant past. But let us know if you have tried your hand at a little bit of coding. How are you finding it? If you've got anything to add to those tips from Craig Brett, we'd love to hear from you. Techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
Today, we're going to hear about Sensible, a multi-directional cane tip that can make quite a difference when navigating with your white cane. Joining us now is Peter Ricards, who, together with his son, designed this cane tip. Now, Peter is going to join us momentarily, but first, let's hear how Sensible works in practice.
So, I'm coming up to a curb. Now, I'm at the curb and I've got the cane tip in front of me. It's a down ramp. And it's able to detect the difference between the bitumen and the cement. You can feel the difference in surface with this tip. Now I'm crossing the road and I'm coming up to a curb. What I really like about this is the way it just hits the curb and then rolls up. Now I'm onto some grass and I'm walking along. I'm on a footpath. There's a bit of a gap between the footpath and the nature strip. In other words, the nature strip is lower than the footpath. A lot of cane tips get stuck here. They hit it, they'd be stuck. You'd have to lift them up. This one, you hit it and it rolls up. So that makes life so much easier.
So we've heard how it works. Now let's hear from the man behind Sensible. Peter, it is lovely speaking with you today.
Nice to be with you from the other side of the world.
I know we are chatting all the way over from Melbourne. So would you mind telling us what inspired you to create this cane tip design?
Yes, well, I have always had low vision, but 5 years ago when I needed to use a white mobility cane, I got a lesson from a mobility instructor. And the very first day I was walking around the block, around the block, caught the tip of the white cane on a raised piece in the pavement. The cane jabbed me in the stomach and I thought, this isn't too good. So I asked the mobility trainer if there were any other tips which were more conducive to going forwards as well as sideways. And she said, no, there wasn't. So I went to my industrial design trained son and said, how about we start this project together. That was 5 years ago, and now the journey started from there.
And how difficult was it to design it together? Did you go through a lot of, I guess, first versions of this final design?
What he would do is come up with a design, a prototype, and give it to me, and I would test it to destruction and go back and say, these are the problems with it, these are the faults. He would change it, and then we would try the next one, and eventually we ended up with the Sensible, which is very sensible design, actually. Works very well.
I do have to say, I love the pun on the name, but we heard a little bit of what it works out like in practice, but which sort of environments do you think Sensible really shines?
Particularly good for safety, going down stairs and down rough tracks and things, because you, unlike other canes, you can run it over the edge of the steps and it tells you exactly where the edge of the step is. Or an escalator, you can just hold it on the step down and it'll tell you when you're coming off the escalator. Also, it's particularly good when you're going with a sighted guide, because my partner, Kathy, when I go walking with her, for example, I just run it in front of my feet about 2 foot or 2/3 of a meter in front of my feet. She doesn't have to tell me what's coming up in the way of gutters or dips or holes in the road or anything, and I can know exactly what's coming up, and she's much more relaxed. The other thing that's good about it is that a lot of people over time get a lot of RSI from using canes constantly, catching on things and jolting up their arms and so forth, and Sensible doesn't seem to do that at all. It runs over most things without any sort of jolting or catching on things like that.
So you have this final design now. How many have you had other people test it out as well? Where are you currently when it comes to maybe bringing it to the market?
Well, what we're doing is we've got the final prototype, and it fits almost every cane, either by having it fitting over the end of the cane. We've got a multiple a tightening device which fits a range of cane diameters, or those that have hook canes. I've got a tip called a Sensible hook adapter, which goes on the end of a hook cane, like a pencil tip, and it can go on that. But what we're doing is people who want to pre-order one can go to our website. We've got three options available. Either they can pre-order one at a discount, first to have one in their hand, or they can donate equivalent amount to charities around the world which need to have these to help blind people in mobility situations, or they can just donate to help us raise the funds to get this manufactured. We've got the tooling costs are extremely expensive, for example, and we're trying to raise some money to help the tooling costs so that the ultimate cost of a Sensible will be a lot less to the consumer, the blind person, vision impaired person at the end of the day. So our website is www.sensable.com.au.
I think you kind of touched upon this. So I guess your hope is to have this product available, not just in Australia, but pretty much across the world.
Absolutely. We've been contacting organizations around the world who have mobility training people. Ultimately, we'd like to get one into the hands of every mobility trainer in all the different agencies for the blind and vision impaired around the world, so that they can show it to their clients or to their training people, because we think it's got great value and great improvements, because as you know, most of the tips these days only go left and right, and this is sort of an innovation, a big step up, revolutionary change in tips. There are many, many, many different types of white canes on the market, but not many tips that are multi-directional, if any.
Well, Peter, could we hear that website address again, if that's all right?
Yes, www.sensable.com.au. And if you want to help us in some way, contribute or order one, or contribute in any other way, click on the Kickstarter campaign, which we have going at the moment until the 15th of November.
Well, Peter, it's been lovely speaking with you today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to Paulina there sharing a bit of information about SenseBall, that kind of multi-directional cane tip, which reminded me, I think Ambitech have also developed a multi-directional cane tip called the Pathfinder 360. I had a little test drive, or should I say I took it for a spin. a couple of weeks ago, right? And it was a bit like an unruly shopping trolley, but maybe that was just me. Have either of you tried any of these kind of multi-directional ball tips on either of your canes? Are you a cane user, Jackie? I'm not quite sure.
Yes. Yeah, I am a long cane user. But I've just got an ordinary tip on it at the moment, but I have had... I did enjoy using the ball, you know, the large balls on the end of the cane. But the trouble with them was that they broke quite easily. I found them, you know, they often split in half. So I've just gone.
Even the high mileage ones.
Well, I don't know what sort of mileage they had, Hubert, but I did find the ones I was using on the Ambitech cane. They sort of did split. I had a couple of them, so I've just gone back to a standard tip.
So when you've got a roller,
but I, yeah,
you got a roller tip, yeah, okay.
I have, yeah, but I would like to try one of these new fandangled sense ball or the new whatever you call it.
I remember at school we had to learn with a very straight, almost like a pencil tip, you know, and it would get stuck in all the, you know, the cracks and potholes on the pavement. It was deeply frustrating. And then I think I graduated to a pear tip, and like you, Jackie, I now got a standard roller tip. Be interested to know what people think about these multi-directional ball tips though, and let us know how you customize your cane. Tech talk at rnib.org.uk, and you're guide dog all the way, aren't you, Hubert?
Yes, although I have been a cane user before then, I've tried many a tips, including what I'd call, there's a few different ones, including what I kind of refer to and what people start calling the mushroom tip, which was basically like a roller tip, but it was more flat and kind of looked like a top hat for a mushroom, which was quite interesting, an interesting tip. And then I've tried the roller balls, and I found a high mileage one actually on the RNIB shop website a long time ago, which... it made it more durable, but I found made it a lot heavier as well, which for someone who I kind of need a lightweight cane for my wrist, which I used to use before I got a guide dog, a heavy ball at the end of the cane certainly did not really help with that issue.
All right. Well, we're interested to hear what you use and what led you to that choice. And have you tried anything else? Tech talk at rnib.org.uk. Jackie Hubert, thanks a lot.
For blind and partially sighted musicians, communication can sometimes be one of the most challenging elements of learning and playing an instrument. The TapTap is a clever new device that hopes to help musicians hit all the right notes. I'm joined now by developer Leon Liu and music teacher and researcher Chase Crispin. Welcome in both.
Hello. Hi.
Thanks for having us. I'm a longtime RNIB listener, so it's great to be here.
Well, Leon, tell us a bit about the problem that you're hoping to solve with the TapTap.
Yeah, well, so as part of my PhD studies, something that I started looking into was just trying to see how could music learning be made more accessible for blind, low vision folk. And that's how Chase and I actually met through kind of a lot of my initial research. One of the key challenges that, and I'm sure Chase can kind of like talk much more about this, that we kind of found was this idea of nonverbal communication. So in contemporary music settings, what we noticed was that, you know, if you're sighted, you might use kind of gestures, facial expressions, you know, everything with your body to kind of indicate a lot of information. And this just happens with like music teachers, with conductors, even with fellow performers. And unfortunately, this might not be accessible to blind and low vision folks. So we started thinking about how could we try to find a design intervention to solve that.
And Chase, is that what you found in your experience as a music teacher, that communication really is difficult for blind or partially sighted musicians?
Absolutely. I think growing up as a kid, being involved in music, getting a music degree in college, there were so many times that no matter how much information I had in audio or in Braille, there was so much information that was left out. And then the time that I realized this the most was when I teach mostly sighted students. The first blind student that I had in a class, I realized even as a blind person, and I've been blind since birth, I was showing so much visual information and I was actually not doing a very good job of providing information in a non-visual way to my blind student, even though I had been in his shoes. And that was the experience from the teacher perspective when I realized how easy it is to show things visually, even as a blind person in a music setting, because there's so much reliance on non-verbal communication and on visual things.
Well, Leon, tell us a bit about the tap-tap. How does it work?
Yeah, so one kind of design intervention that we started looking into was this idea of communicating using vibration of some sort. It kind of made sense to us because that means that would also not interfere with actually the music itself or the sounds that you're producing or listening to. So we thought of designing these. So it's a pair of devices that would be put on by you and your partner. That could be a music teacher or a fellow musician. And basically imagine kind of tapping your heels together to send a real-time vibration signal to the paired device. And it's two-way communication. So effectively, you and I could decide what a certain vibration code means. For example, like a long and short could mean something versus too short could mean something else and so on. And then when we're actually engaging in music, either during performances or even during practice, we can already kind of like, I can just give you this little bit of information in that moment without having to kind of like stop and talk about it or disturb the flow of kind of the music being performed. So that was the idea behind the TapTap prototypes. They're called tap-tap because, well, all that you're really doing is just tapping your heels together.
And as you say, there isn't a set language or way of communicating for the tap-tap. Have you found, Leon, that different people use the device in completely different ways?
Totally. And this was kind of like, as part of my PhD studies, that's exactly the question that we're trying to like look into. So what we did was that we partnered with this music school based in New York City for blind and low vision folk known as the FMDG Music School. And we gave these prototypes to students and teachers to use for a period of 2 months. And every week they kind of develop new language and new ways of kind of interpreting it. We noticed that some things work better than others, of course. So for example, because it's just basically a straight vibration signal, things which are like musical information, such as like just like rhythm or tempo or timing of things was quite intuitive. And, you know, in that moment, you could kind of just tell somebody or indicate that, okay, you're going slightly too slow or slightly too fast. So a lot of that stuff was intuitive. But then we also had teachers who started creating actual codes. So one super interesting thing that we found was, how do people create codes here? And one teacher said that, you know, let's take the most important piece of information, the thing that I might remind you the most during a music lesson, and let's relate that to like a simple code. And that was really useful.
Well, Chase, how have you found using the TapTap?
The first thing that stood out to me was how instantaneous it is, because it is wireless. The two devices are not connected with a wire, and I had expected there to be some latency between sending a signal and receiving it. And it is incredibly instant. And I think that was what showed me how versatile it could be, because I can get the feedback, get the vibration the exact second that the other person is sending it. And it is so real time. So I think that's what's been most helpful in any situation where I've tried it, is it can respond in the moment to whatever your need might be, whether that's in a lesson, needing to correct something, or a signal you might need during a performance. You can get that signal right away. And I think some people go into projects like this when they hear about them thinking that it has a specific use case or there's directions for use it this specific way. And the thing that is great about this, as someone who performs and teaches and who plays multiple instruments, is that the person who's using it has complete freedom to decide how can I make this work for me? What do I need from this device? Because every person is going to have different needs. So it's super flexible, super instantaneous, and can overcome so many of those complexities of how am I going to know this detail or when this thing is happening. So I've really enjoyed trying it and just experimenting throughout this process.
Leon, you're a PhD student in Carleton University in Ottawa in Canada. How did you become interested in this area of work?
I had a really simple kind of like motivation when I started my PhD studies, which was I wanted to make a like positive impact in the world in some way, while combining kind of like my own kind of lived experiences and technical knowledge. I've been playing music from a very young age, but I am a sighted person. But music has been really important just in terms of me, you know, expressing myself in ways that I didn't know what I was feeling, or even like, you know, finding community and finding friends. So when I started my PhD studies and I started looking into this topic, I realized that actually, if you're blind or low vision, that experience is really, really different. And I felt that there are kind of opportunities here to kind of like introduce something and do something that's meaningful. So that was really my idea behind it.
And Chase, what was your role in the development?
So I took part, as Leon mentioned earlier, in his first phase of just looking at what are the needs in terms of blind music learners. And he reached out after that first phase was complete and just asked if I would be interested in being part of this. I think it's helped him, but also helped me as we've kind of talked through the project, that I can speak from both the musician standpoint and from the teacher standpoint. I am someone that learned music all by ear all the way through high school. And then when I went to college, I realized I need to learn Braille music. And so I learned Braille music and I use Braille music every day. But I think there's always been a gap in the middle of, there's a lot of things that are great about Braille. There's a lot of things that are great about learning by ear, but that doesn't include all of the things that a musician needs to know. And so I've always enjoyed technology, playing with it, doing training on technology, keeping up with new tech. So it was a way for me to kind of combine what I felt like I needed as a musician and as a teacher with just being curious about technology, combining those things together and being able to make a difference and help create something that can be another option in a toolbox for a blind musician.
Leon, who do you think the TapTap is suitable for? Did you design it for a certain type of musician, somebody who is just starting, or is it for people who are well on their way to, you know, to learning and being proficient in their instrument?
Yeah. So again, like when we were designing this, because we were looking at it as an experiment and a study, we purposely didn't want to make that assumption. But we found a couple of different things from kind of when we gave it to students and teachers. So a lot of the students and teachers were very proficient. Some were professional musicians, some were early learners. We had a good mix. A lot of the teachers would say that this was really, really good for experts, because what they could do in that moment is just kind of like, you know, perfect like a certain piece. Like, for example, once you already know the notes, once you already have the timing, then the teacher could like just give these very subtle hints to the student about, you know, okay, just kind of build up a little bit more here, or spend a little bit more time emphasizing this particular part. So for that polishing, I think it worked really well. But having said that, I felt that also for beginners, this was super useful, because at times with like, you know, complex rhythm or things like that, this gave them like a new way of actually feeling and understanding those things, which might not be super intuitive because they're still kind of new to music. So again, I'm hoping that this is useful for a lot of different people.
Well, Leon, what comes next for the TapTap?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and something that I've been asked before. I don't have an immediate answer to that. We are working on a second project that's kind of developed from what we learned over here. So I'll just kind of maybe plug that in. So there's another PhD student who's, her name is Caroline, and she's based in the University of Bath. So one super, other than being an amazing researcher and person, she's also somebody who is deafblind. And somebody who is losing her eyesight and her vision over the period of time. I met her a few years ago, and something that she told me, we actually met at a conference, and something that she told me was she wants to be the first deafblind person to summit Mount Everest. And it kind of blew my mind. And she's this amazingly like inspirational yet completely humble person. And we started having a lot of discussions about the challenges in those scenarios. And interestingly enough, nonverbal communication is also super applicable in that situation, because you have a guide and you have her who have to kind of navigate kind of like in these really adverse conditions outdoors, and getting real-time information in some way can be really useful. Like, for example, just, you know, watch out on your left or move a little bit to your right and so on. So we're actually in the process to develop a prototype that she can actually use on like when she's actually climbing a mountain with a guide, and see how that kind of develops. If you're more interested about that, her website is called Deafblind Everest Project, and it's an amazing place that we're hopefully doing some interesting stuff with.
And where are we currently with the TapTap? Is it something that you're hoping to get out to musicians and to schools, universities, places like that where people are learning music?
So I definitely want to make sure that all of this stuff is open source. That means that anybody who has access to a Maker Lab or just some kind of like fundamental technical knowledge can basically get their hands on this device and also make it their own. So my aim is to kind of have the code, the fabrication, all of that to be open source. So anyone can basically access that. Even the parts and components that are currently that we've currently used are commercially available. For example, the microbit, which is kind of the brains of the operation, it's a $13 or $17 microcontroller that you can purchase on Amazon, for example. So nothing which is there is proprietary, and we want to make sure that like folks can actually access this in ways that they can.
Well, where's the best way to follow along with the TapTap journey and find out more about your work?
Yeah, at the moment, I don't really have a website. I have an Instagram handle called work_in_progress. And I have also a Twitter handle. That's kind of with air. That's the only place where I can, at the moment, I'm kind of sharing the work on progress. But hopefully in the future, we'll have more platforms to actually show what's going on.
Fantastic. Well, a really unique device with clearly lots of applications still to come in the future. The TapTap device, developer Leon Liu and music teacher and researcher Chase Crispin. Thanks for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
Now, it's that time of year. It's cold out there. The weather's not great. And what often tends to happen is a lot of people tend to get ill around this time of year. And therefore, one of the important factors to know is your body temperature. But how do you check it when you are blind or partially sighted? Are there solutions? Yes, there are. Today, what I will show you is the talking ear and forehead thermometer from our very own Products for Life store. So I've got it in front of me right here. I've taken it out of the box, which has the thermometer inside it, an instruction manual, and a little cool stand where you can put the thermometer into it if you're not using it. It doesn't charge it. It just sits there being funky. So let's describe the thermometer to you. It's about 131 grams, so not very heavy. It's a long object with the probe sticking out of the front of it. And I quite like it. The shape, it reminds me a little bit of a boomerang, if you can try to picture that. On the front of the thermometer is the probe for the forehead. And if you take the cap off that probe, you then expose the probe that goes into the ear to check the temperature. I will replace the cap so I can use the forehead part of it. Below that is an LCD display, fairly decent size for the device size, to be honest. Below that is the MEM button, spelt M-E-M, and that button is used for memory and setting functions. Now, by memory, I mean it can store up to 30 temperature readings, which you could find useful. I don't really use that feature, but you can do so, and you can look through these readings. On the right-hand side of the thermometer is a long button which you press to take the ear reading for your temperature. We'll then go to the back. On the back is a big button with two little lines on it. That is the button you press to take the forehead reading. Below that is the speaker grill for the speech and the announcements. Below that is then your battery compartment, which houses two AAA batteries, which come with the device, but they do have a plastic tab that you need to take out of the battery compartment in order for the device to be used. Now, the confusing part here. So I will take off the battery compartment lid. So in here, you've obviously got the two batteries sitting in there. And below that, you've got the torque button, which, amongst many things, does read you the current time if you set it. And it will read you also the temperature in the room. So it's a really useful button, actually. What confuses me slightly is why it's in such a strange location, i.e. underneath the battery compartment lid. It's a bit strange, but hey-ho. So I've not set the time here. Now, I'll tell you for why. Because one, I don't really need it. I have many other things telling me the time. Two, you also require sighted assistance to set the time. And you can find out instructions on how to do that with the thermometer in the box, or you can download accessible instructions from our shop website. So I'll press the button so you can hear the room temperature, but the time you will hear will be incorrect.
Celsius.
28 degrees here, apparently. I will replace the lid now. So it's not a feature you'll use often, but it's a feature that I think is quite nice, and I wish the button was in a more accessible place. So that's the thermometer itself. We're going to now try and take a temperature reading, and we'll do the forehead reading. I'm not the greatest fan of the ear temperature readings, but it's whatever works for you, so I will touch the probe to my forehead and press the big button at the back and see what our temperature is, see if I should be worried.
Your body temperature is 36.4 degrees Celsius.
No need to worry at all. It's a very healthy amount and there's no threat of anything else. So that is the talking ear and forehead thermometer. If you search for the word thermometer on the shop website, three results will come up: the talking food thermometer, this one, and something else. But the alternative is you can enter the product code, which is DH440 Delta Hotel 440. Or you can just call our helpline on 0303 123 9999, and they'll be able to help you complete the purchase. It costs £27.50 with the VAT exemption, and without it, it costs £33. If you have any more questions about the thermometer, maybe you've used it yourself. What do you think of it? Have you found anything that works better? Have you found anything that is worse? Or does this work for you perfectly? And also, if there are other products you would like us to demonstrate from the Products for Life store, well, do let us know too, because we can get hold of them and show you how they work to help you make a decision whether you would like to make the purchase. Let us know. Get in touch. techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
We are done for another Tech Talk. Thank you so much for your company. If you liked what you heard, do tell a friend. And if you've got a question or a comment or a suggestion, we're always delighted to hear from you. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. But from myself, Jackie Brown, and Hubert Pavalkovich, until next time, bye for now.
Bye for now.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.